Today's sponsor is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/Midwestern. That's www.audibletrial.com/Midwestern. And get your free audiobook today. Welcome, everyone, to episode 36 of the Midwestern Social Scientists. This is Keith McIntosh and my friend and colleague.
I am Dr. Kip Pietrantonio.
Kip Pietrantonio. We have been absent for a little while.
We have.
Well, we have a good excuse.
We do.
Or at least I have a good excuse.
I don't.
Which is that I drove 8 hours away from where I had been living in the great state of Ohio to the city of Philadelphia. Because I am now enrolled in a doctoral program at Temple University. I moved to Philadelphia, I guess it was a week ago, roughly. And I'm settling in. And Kip and I now are conducting our podcast long distance, which has some problems, though, some technological problems that we're able to overcome, I think, for the most part, right?
Yeah, I think so. And I think the funny thing about it is I think in a weird way, it's going to end up sounding better.
I think that's true because I think we're more focused now on quality and making sure everything sort of is up to the max level that we can possibly make it, you know, in terms of the vocal quality. And I think I have more attention to detail now because it's forced upon me. I've got to be careful with what I do because we're not just in a room together anymore with a couple of mics.
Yeah, that's true. And I think the other thing is I got this brand new microphone just for the podcast, which is the Blue Yeti microphone. I got it off OfferUp for $90, which was pretty awesome. I mean, usually they go for like $160 or something like that. But it was actually pretty awesome. I got it for really, really cheap. I was pretty excited about it. And it's custom made for podcasting and it looks awesome. So
it does. Yeah, it does. How did you decide on that microphone?
Well, I watched a bunch of YouTube videos. There's a podcast that I really like, and the guy on Facebook, he recommended it. He said, like, this is the best, like, podcasting mic ever. And he's like, I have more expensive ones, and I have, you know, everything else under the sun. And he said, this is the best one, and this is why I love it. And he pointed out some bunch of facts about it. And then I went to YouTube and started reading more about it, watching more videos about people reviewing it. And they just said it's great, and it's got all these cool settings, and that you can kind of interplay with GarageBand, and it comes with this awesome little booklet that says, like, different combinations of, like, sound and how you can adjust the nozzles on it to make it, like, custom for different experiences, depending on, like, if you're having, like, singing versus if you're talking versus if you're trying to sound like you're on the radio versus if you're trying to sound like you're in a, like, a choir.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so I think it's pretty awesome. I'm pretty pumped about it.
Yeah, when we started this, you were kind of novice when it came to like audio issues. But I get the feeling that doing the podcast and buying the microphone and stuff, you're kind of getting into it. You're sort of all geeked up on the quality of it.
Yeah, I think that the cool thing is like when you start paying attention more, you start like noticing. Like last week we did the podcast and I used kind of a shitty microphone and it was like very obvious that it was bad, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that was like embarrassing for me. So for those who listened to the Toronto Agogo episode, most of you Canadians out there, I just want to formally apologize for the audio quality of that episode.
Yeah, and I want to apologize for calling it Mississauga and not Mississauga. I didn't know the pronunciation and I was going to say something in the heat of the moment, but I just let it go and then I realized later. So... to the proud people of Mississauga, I apologize for mispronouncing your city's name.
Yeah, the funny thing was Mississauga became like a big element of my life for like a week.
Really?
Do you ever have stuff like that happen where it's kind of like you never heard of something before and then all of a sudden you hear about it like three times in 1 week?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
That's such a weird thing. So I had that happen with Mississauga. Like, I had never heard of that city before.
Uh-huh.
And then we drove through it, and then you got the feedback about saying it wrong on the podcast from our fans. And then after that, it was so funny, because then I was watching, like, a review on YouTube of, like secrets about GameStop, you know, the store GameStop.
Yeah.
And this guy was like, I'm from Mississauga, and we had the best, we had the most popular GameStop in the whole world for, like, 6 months while I was the manager, and I was just like, wow, this city keeps popping up, and I've never heard of it before this week.
That's funny, because one of the girls in my program, who I just met recently, she lives in Delaware now, but she grew up in Canada, or she was born in Canada, I should say. Mm-hmm. And the city that she was born in, Mississauga. And she just said it randomly, and I thought, oh, that's how you say the name. That's how you pronounce it.
Yeah. Oh man. That's so funny.
I know.
Anyway, Keith, so what are we talking about today in the podcast?
Yeah, without further ado, because we're gonna blabber on without actually introducing the topic. So it's a topic about lists, internet lists, and the kind of bite-size quality to information on the internet. I think BuzzFeed is probably the best example of this, where everything is presented in the sort of most distilled form it could possibly be in. And maybe quality, as a consequence, it hits the cutting room floor or whatever. People forget about quality and instead focus on these kind of bite-sized tidbits.
Right.
And the potential strengths, but mostly the weaknesses of that style.
Right. So I think that the first thing that people sometimes get a little confused about with this is they think that, like, BuzzFeed invented this, and BuzzFeed gets shit on a lot for it. But the truth is, like, women's magazines have been doing this for a very long time. Like, Cosmo, this has been the basis of their readership for, like, 20 years, has been, like, 25 sex tips, 25 ways to make your man go crazy, 25 things that'll make him love you.
Make him go crazy in bed. It's always, it's amazing how many, say, top 50 ways to, like, blow your lover's head or something else come out. Like, it's every other magazine for decades and decades. I wonder if the people who work at Cosmo are just, like, really jaded.
Yeah.
And just like, here's another way to say the same thing again. It's got to be really tough to work at Cosmo for, like, 20 or 30 years.
Right. Well, I think so, too. And I think they're even probably more jaded that BuzzFeed stole their gimmick. Like, they stole their shtick, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that also there's been, like, you know, Fox News and MSNBC and all the news outlets, they do the exact same thing. Except they do it live on television. So they'll say something like, are Pop-Tarts killing your children? Find out now, right after this news break, or something like right after this commercial break. And then you come back and it's totally, like, irrelevant. And it's like one Pop-Tart had some asbestos in it one time in the 1970s, you know, and somebody's making a big deal out of it. And I just think that that's so, it's like an old gimmick, but it's been repackaged in social media, and I just think it's so funny. And then they've added this new part of it too, which is they customize the same lists just for different, like, towns or different places.
Yeah.
And so, like, one thing I'll always see is, like, 25 signs you're from Minnesota, right?
Yeah.
And then you'll look at the list, like, 25 signs you're from Wisconsin, 25 signs you're from Michigan, 25.
And do you take all those tests?
Yeah, no. I mean, these aren't tests. These are just lists. And the thing that's funny about them is they're the exact same things, but just for different states. And sometimes even the same pictures. You know what I mean? So literally all somebody did was stole the list from one list and, like, put a new name on it and then sent it out to the masses again.
Well, do you think this is just an old style that has found a great platform in terms of the internet? Or do you think it's indicative of this era, I guess, with short attention spans, that these kind of top 10 lists have exploded?
Yeah. I think it's actually is, like, more about this era, at least the Facebook version of it, or, like, the internet version of it.
Yeah.
Because it's not like you're going to sit there, buy a magazine, go sit down and start reading it. Now it's like, oh, I've got 10 minutes on break. I'm quickly going to look at this list. And literally, I'm not even going to read anything else other than the titles of each list. So I'm just going to go through and I'm literally going to read 25 words or 25 mm-hmm. sentences, and that's all I'm going to consume. So.
Yeah. Yeah, there's something, there's an odd, like, titillation you get with, I think, changing from one input source to another, so to speak. So I remember as a kid watching television and watching a lot of TV and getting to the point where I'd seen everything and there were only reruns on, let's say, and the sensation of changing from one channel to the other and having a new image pop up in front of my eyes was kind of, like, exciting, you know, just like a little... like jolt of pleasure, kind of like here's a new thing to look at, new stimulation, and then changing right. it again and changing it again, and like the actual process of channel surfing became like an activity, and that's right. basically what the internet is in a sense. You click on a link and you're transported to another page and another page, and I see the BuzzFeed list as the kind of like the climax of that progression, you know what I mean? Like it's just right. boom 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 boom. And there's something really enjoyable about going from one like funny picture and fun fact to something else. And but it's completely like absent of any real like depth or quality or substance. It's just purely like this kind of like psychological thrill of flipping from one channel to the next. And so I think people use it just as kind of downtime. So between a task at work or something, you know, hanging out with their friends or having a conversation. It's just like a way of decompressing maybe and kind of checking out and just this sort of, it's like the new version of channel surfing. At least that's right. how I see it. That's how I relate to it.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I totally agree with that. I think that you've actually mentioned that on the podcast a few times before, Keith, your kind of fascination with channel surfing. And yeah. I think that's pretty interesting because I think most people view channel surfing as like really boring. Like it's kind of the thing. It's like the thing between pleasure. You know what I mean? Like you're kind of on the pursuit of pleasure and not finding any, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm wondering what's up with that.
Yeah, me too. I don't know, man. Yeah. I think it's just, I don't like TV that much. Like occasionally I find a show that's of real quality, like Mad Men or something. I haven't gotten into The Sopranos, which I shouldn't admit because people are going to kill me for that. But when I find a show like that, I really get invested in it. I really like it. But I think in general, just to sit down for half an hour and watch a sitcom, which already is going to have like three sets of commercials. There's so many commercials on American television. I don't find it that enjoyable. I just don't. I'd rather sit and have a conversation, or I'd rather do something else. So I think if I'm perched on the couch and I'm looking for something to watch, there's a weird kind of like hypnotic, almost like meditative thing of like click next channel, click next channel. It's almost right. like a weird, like the way they say if you grow up next to the ocean, the waves, you know, like cresting, like just becomes like this very soothing kind of background noise. I feel like I spent so much time watching TV as a kid that just that like clicking of the channels is somehow like oddly soothing and oddly like pleasurable. It is boring. It's totally boring. It's not like exciting. And yet I still find myself doing that for a long time.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I don't know. Maybe you're weird.
Yeah. I think we've established that quite a long time ago. That's probably fair to say.
I just went and saw the David Foster Wallace movie. For those who don't know, David Foster Wallace is a writer who passed away, I think, in like 2009 or 2008, Keith.
I think 2008.
Yeah, 2008. He committed suicide, unfortunately. But they made a movie, and I think it's Jason Segel plays him in the movie. The movie's called The End of the Tour. And there's a scene where he's, like, watching TV.
Yeah.
And it just shows him being, like, completely fascinated by TV. Like, he's just staring at it in, like, an obsessive way. Mm-hmm. And, like, he's on the edge of his seat, and he's just, like, eating food and consuming. And it, like, looks... so American and like such a, it almost looks like he's like mocking himself or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But later on he talks about addiction because there's like these rumors going around that he's addicted to heroin, which he's uh-huh. not, according to him at least. And he says, he's like, I'm not addicted to heroin. He's like, I'm addicted to television. And I know it's not as sexy or not as cool as like other addictions. And I know your readers aren't going to really like it because the guy with him is interviewing him. He's like, but that's what I'm addicted to. And that's what I can't get enough of. And that's why I don't have a television in my house. You know?
Oh, wow.
So it's kind of like what you just described.
No, totally. Yeah. And I've heard him say that he died. I think he was interviewed by Charlie Rose a few times, actually. And they're all really good, by the way. You can, for anyone listening, go ahead and check those out on YouTube. It's worth to watch. But he says in one of the interviews, he doesn't have a TV. And I thought that was kind of fascinating because a big part of like Infinite Jest is about addiction. And it was odd to me that he wrote this story about like the addictive potential of television, and then the guy himself doesn't even have a TV. So I kind of wondered if he hated it. But it's interesting to me that he, assuming the movie depicts something accurate, it's interesting to me that he was that, I don't know, he got that much pleasure from it.
Yeah, he seemed to really get a lot from it, for sure. So.
I remember some interview with him, he was discussing being a kid and watching TV with his father, and there was a movie on, like an old classic movie, I think, and it was like a bonding experience with him and his dad, but he was interrupted over and over again by commercials. And he was just reflecting on that, that the memory of the story was completely filled up with, you know, Crest toothpaste and, Depends adult undergarment commercials or what have you. And I thought that was kind of interesting, too, that that was something he noticed.
Right. Well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it seems like a very David Foster Wallace-y thing to notice. So...
Yeah,
I wish I had more to say.
Hey, can you give a recommendation? Because I haven't seen the movie yet, but I'm a big David Foster Wallace fan.
Yeah, I would say it's worth seeing. I mean, I don't know if you have to see it in the theater necessarily, because it's not like a theater movie. Like for me, I only go see movies in the theater usually that are really, really like blockbusters, you know?
Yeah.
Because I'm pretty patient and I can wait for a movie to come out. If you like video games, you become very patient because games get delayed all the time. So I'm always like, well, this movie's going to be out on DVD in 6 months. No problem. I'm used to waiting 5 years for a video game to come out. So
that's kind of funny. I got to be honest. I don't think I ever thought of that before.
Yeah.
Like the amount of time that takes.
Yeah. So, I mean, everybody I think who's a David Foster Wallace fan should definitely see it. And I can maybe recommend going and seeing it in the theater. But if you're just like a casual movie fan and you know like nothing about David Foster Wallace, it's probably worth just like renting on DVD, or you might not find it all that interesting. So,
yeah.
But so Keith, while we were chatting here about David Foster Wallace, I went ahead and went on to BuzzFeed.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to read just a couple of the things that are on there right now.
I was going to say, okay? Like, is this going to be the top 10 David Foster Wallace books?
No, I wish it was that good. That would be remarkably awesome if it was that good. So you ready for the first list?
Shoot.
12 celebrities who would look even better with man buns.
With what?
With man buns. Like,
what
you
is
know,
a
like
man
little,
bun?
It's like the little poof of hair.
Oh, the hipster bun. I know what that is.
Yeah, so I mean, in case you wanted 12 celebrities... So you're immediately thinking they must have done some kind of like really great analysis where they like looked at people and, you know, put on these man buns and like kind of pictured like the shape of their face. But the truth is, here's what they did. They took funny celebrities and they made it so you can scroll across the screen where somebody very poorly photoshopped a man bun on their head. So the very first person is Patrick Stewart. And then there's
Patrick Stewart. Isn't he bald, Patrick Stewart?
Yeah, exactly. He's bald.
Oh, wow.
So all they did, that's what I mean by they just very poorly photoshopped Paul Rudd, Hugh Jackman. And none of these people look better. I mean, obviously.
Yeah.
So really what they did is they just took pictures that would probably work and then of celebrities and just threw it on there. And it's a complete waste of my time. I'm looking at it right now. I'm just... For whatever reason, I feel compelled to keep going through them and looking at all of them.
So
as if I don't know what John Hamm would look like with a ponytail.
I want to know. I want to know what John Hamm would look like with a ponytail. Maybe if Mad Men kept going like into the late 70s, you would have seen John Hamm with a ponytail. But because it ended before that, it's necessary to go to BuzzFeed, I think.
But see, here's the thing right here, Keith. Like right now, there's a big difference between you and I because you are on the precipice of the BuzzFeed article and I am on the other end of it. Okay? So we are, you and I right now are paralleling what actually happens when you're before and after on a BuzzFeed article, right? So I say to you, oh man, don't you want to see what John Hamm would look like with a man bun?
Yeah, totally, man. Let me see John Hamm with a man bun.
Right, and then I would show it to you, and I'm looking at it right now, and it's totally unsatisfying. Like, it's just,
It's just stupid looking. Like, it doesn't look good. All they did was they took somebody else's hair and photoshopped it onto his head.
And that
right there is exactly how these lists work. Uh-huh. Which, the amazing thing for me is that people keep opening them day after day after day.
Are you one of those people, or are you just experimenting right now for purposes of scientific inquiry?
I think it for a little while I was one of those people, and then I just realized like how completely unfulfilling it is. You know,
it sounds like channel surfing to me. It sounds fantastic. It sounds boring and oddly enjoyable. I feel like I could just spend forever on BuzzFeed. In fact, a couple of days ago at the orientation at Temple University, there was a girl in front of me in the giant auditorium being taught how to be a teaching assistant. And I noticed throughout the demonstration, she was on BuzzFeed the entire time. And you could just see her just digging for stuff to get into. I could tell she was bored, and I could tell she was not satisfied because she kept like flipping back to the things she'd already seen. She was just like going through BuzzFeed, just desperately trying to click on some link that would bring her a little distraction and pleasure. But she wasn't able to find it. I don't think. Maybe this is a good example supporting your critique.
Right, but I think the other problem I guess I have with that, and well, for one, I don't think she was probably even thinking about the BuzzFeed article she was looking at. Like, I think it's in the same way like knitting just provides people with something to do with their hands.
Yeah,
I think that's kind of what she was doing. The other thing that I would say about it that I think is really unfortunate is that she was probably just chronically dissatisfied each time she opened everything. Like, she probably thought it was going to be interesting and then went back to tuning out.
Do you think there's a kind of intrinsic limit to pleasure? Like, the human brain just can't experience, like, the maximum endlessly. The only way to have a few moments of, like, the max is also to go to the min and also to sort of be in the middle most of the time. I feel like there's just kind of, like, this sense that it's your God-given right to be full of pleasure and like titillated all the time, and people are just constantly like, it reminds me of some psychology experiment that I can't quite recall, I'm sure you would, where I think monkeys had the ability to like hit a button and get a little shot of what dopamine and what have you, some kind of pleasure, and they end up getting to a point where they just hit the button constantly and like they're constantly passing out, and it's only once they've regained a little bit of consciousness enough to hit the button again that they do, and so basically they become catatonic, the pleasure kind of like kills them.
Really? Well, I don't know. You know, I don't know about that study. I can't remember. I've not heard of that study, to be honest. Like, that definitely probably could have happened. That sounds like a kind of a unethical early 50s and 40s monkey.
I think
classic
it was.
monkey study.
Yeah.
They've done a lot of abusive things to monkeys in psychology. One of which is a really big one, is Harry Harlow. You know, like the Harlow monkeys. You've heard of that?
No. Tell me again. It's been a while.
Okay, so basically Harry Harlow wanted to prove that like comfort and like compassion was just as important as like food for babies.
Yeah.
So basically they gave like a baby, they had two of these wire mother monkeys made. So they're monkeys, they were made out of wire, and they like, one had milk, and then one had milk and like cloth.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially what happened was they found that like hugging, they would want to like, the baby monkeys would go to the one with cloth more often because they figured out like, oh, like they also want the comfort of being held, like that's an important thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of a shot in the, like, it was kind of like babies aren't just like these selfish little like, oh, I just want to eat, you know, there's like mm-hmm. more to them than that.
Yeah,
so that was a big study. But one of the things that Harlow did, all kinds of monkey studies, and one thing he had was called the rape rack.
What?
Yeah, and it was like this, and he had like this like pit of despair where he would like put monkeys and like isolate them.
The pit of despair.
That's real. And the rape rack. And the rape rack really was like exactly what it sounds like it was.
Oh my God. This sounds like if he had been like of a different generation, the government would have tapped him for the Guantanamo interrogation technique.
Right. No, that's not even, that's like a real thing. That really happened. So he had like these terrible torturing devices for monkeys.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, he was like testing love and empathy. It was like this bizarre
thing. Who was this? This was an American?
Yeah, Harry Harlow, he was definitely an American. I can look up more about him as we go here.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I do remember reading about that original monkey experiment in, must have been Psychology 101. freshman year, maybe sophomore year. It was like a pretty famous study, right?
Oh yeah, like the Harlow Monkeys is super crazy.
Yeah, the pleasure thing, I couldn't tell you who conducted the experiment, but I mean, what I described was basically the gist of it, that they gave the monkey control of this one droplet of a painkiller, I think. And once the monkey realized that there was this connection between the button being pressed and then this release, it just pressed it incessantly. But the result of that was basically being in a coma, more or less. And it doesn't necessarily translate to people, but I tend to think it is, it indicates something. I think there is a desire for pleasure, but pleasure isn't always a good thing in the long run. And David Foster Wallace was all about that idea.
Yeah, the other thing is, I do know of one study with that with rats, where they had given, like, if they put a rat alone in a cage and they gave it milk that had, like, some kind of, like, basically, like, heroin or something like that, had some kind of drug in it or something like that. Like, if the rat was alone by itself, it would drink that milk like crazy until it died, pretty much. Mm-hmm. But, and it would ignore the other, like, the non-heroin milk. But they would also, really interestingly, if they put a whole community of rats in there, the rats wouldn't drink the heroin milk as much. In fact, sometimes they would, like, ostracize the milk and be like, don't drink that, that's bad.
Really?
So, yeah, so they also know that that addiction tendency has a lot to do with, like, community, and if you're getting your needs met in other ways. So the rat, you know, or the monkey being alone by themselves in the cage impacts whether or not they would become addicted or become overcome with pleasure.
That's fascinating. That's just fascinating. I wonder if it seems to be a kind of vicious cycle, though, because if you start to get sucked in to, say, taking the heroin milk or whatever the pleasure is in real life, and then you get ostracized and you don't have a community to turn to, you're probably more likely to turn back to the heroin milk. I really like that expression, heroin milk, even though it's very dark and gloomy for some odd reason. It makes me perk up. Yeah, and then there's a kind of like a spiral, you know, a descent. I suppose, actually, we could just take the milk part of it away and just say heroin, for example. If you're a drug user, that would be stigmatizing. People wouldn't talk to you anymore.
Definitely. I mean, I think it fits. It translates really well. And I mean, if you're a heroin user, you're also probably not a person with a lot of friends to begin with, you know, which is more likely you're going to seek out drugs for comfort, you know. The other thing, though, Keith, is I wouldn't make the argument that pleasure has like a pinnacle, you know, or anything like that. What I would actually say is this other word, which is we habituate.
Yeah.
Meaning that when you eat a piece of pizza, the first bite is like amazing. But every bite after that becomes less amazing. Yeah. And that's because we habituate to the pleasure. And then if you take like a 10-minute break, or you like take an hour break and you eat like something else in between, like you unhabituate to it again. Mm-hmm. So then you can like eat pizza again and it'll be good again, but it probably still won't be as good as the first bite. And so I would say that's true. So like you may go on to BuzzFeed like every single day and kind of like get tricked over and over and over again. But eventually BuzzFeed, like, it loses its
buzz. Its power. It's buzz.
It loses its buzz relatively quickly. But the problem is that people delay and they get the quick, like, 25 things the next day, and then they get excited again, you know?
Yeah. Well, maybe if you can limit your BuzzFeed intake to a prescribed dose from a licensed psychologist to once a week, once a month.
That's right. You absolutely could. So going back a little bit, Harry Harlow was an American.
Okay.
Just to let you know, he taught, I think, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which he's a Wisconsin guy.
A lot of really strange people are from Madison, we've discovered.
It's a weird town. Has a weird effect on psychologists to be from there, apparently. The other thing is, he is a Midwestern social scientist.
Oh, wow, just like us.
Just like us. Now, Keith, I also want to go back to BuzzFeed and keep going through what I discovered here. So you're ready for the next one? The next one is a quiz.
Okay.
Now, tell me what your impact, like when you see a cool quiz on the internet, what are you thinking about?
I think I can't wait to dive into this for about 5 minutes and find out what kind of person I am. That's what I think.
Yeah.
It's going to tell me, am I introverted? Am I extroverted? What kind of celebrity am I? Like what type of hipster am I? You know, that's the kind of thing I want to know.
What do you think is attractive about knowing that?
I think there's some sense of, like, if I claim that I'm really cool, but everybody in my life tells me that I'm nerdy, then I can't really, I have to accept the like a label that others put upon me. There's a kind of objective quality to one's identity. So you may want to be something in your own head, but if everybody tells you you're something else, you just sort of are that thing. There's something oddly gratifying and you feel like it's truth when in something external and objective, I guess there's some algorithm involved, right? You click, you know, A for number one and C for number two, and there's some formulation and it spits out this category. And you feel like it's almost like scientific. This is me. This has to be me. And it's seeing yourself with fresh eyes.
Yeah. So it's almost for you, it's almost like the Harry Potter sorting hat. Like it's
what is that?
How do you not know what the Harry Potter sorting hat is?
I hate Harry Potter. I don't give a shit. I'm a grown man. I don't care about Harry Potter. I also haven't read Harry Potter, I'll be honest.
Yeah, so you don't know shit. So that's what you're saying.
No, I don't know shit about shit.
Okay, so...
please tell me, though. Enlighten me.
Okay, so Harry Potter... How you get sorted... You've heard of the different houses. Like, you've heard of Gryffindor. And, yep. And Slytherin. And yep. Hufflepuff and Ravenclaw.
Yeah, I do. I do know this because of other people that I used to play.
Okay, so there's four houses in Harry Potter. And essentially what happens is they put this little hat on all the little first-year Hogwarts children, and it talks to them, and it's like, hey, which house should you go sorted into based on your personality? And so you have a little bit of negotiation room. Like, Harry... Like, when Harry gets it on his head, the hat is like, hey, man, you could go into Slytherin and be, like, really mighty and amazing. And that's kind of like the evil house. And yeah. He's like, oh, don't put me in Slytherin. Like, I want to be in the good house, which is, like, Gryffindor. So then the hat, like, listens and puts him in Gryffindor. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
I think it's that same kind of sensation when you take one of these quizzes. Like, I agree with you there. It's like you want to figure out, like, oh, this is going to figure out who I am for real, objectively. But the truth is, Keith, it's not. It's fucking really? Not. It's not going to do that. It's going to give you...
I think your analogy was spot on. But yeah. What does it give me?
It's going to give you random shit. Like, that's what it's going to do. Like, there's nothing about what you're going to give the information. I would bet it literally spits out 90% of the time a random answer.
Really?
Yeah, I think maybe like it's tilted a little bit. Like if you answer one question one way, it's like automatic. But I will bet there's almost no effort put into like making the algorithm for which Pixar movie are you based on your zodiac sign.
Yeah. I feel like sometimes though it does say so. I feel like I've taken those tests where I kind of do feel like it is able to, I don't know, zoom in on something about me where I feel like, oh, geez, that really is me. But I'm probably just a big dope and projecting.
Well, the other thing, though, that's kind of bullshit about it is you can kind of shape it however you want.
Yeah.
Have you ever got an answer you didn't like, then gone backwards, changed some of your answers so you could get the answer you like?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I just don't stop until I get what I like. I just
okay. So Keith, I want to take you through this. I want to take you through how scientific this one is. So the one on Pixar right now, the one on BuzzFeed right now is, which Pixar movie are you based on your zodiac sign? Okay,
is that really what it is?
That's what it is. So it opens.
Because I just
up,
figured you, I figured you made that up as a kind of like being sarcastic. You know what I mean?
I wish I did, Keith. God damn it, I wish I did. But okay, so you're lay ready down for this? Me. So here's what it is. It says, what's your sign? And then it's
Leo.
It's written in like the Pixar font with the little lamp, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So, okay. So I go down. I'm going to go down and I'm going to select Leo, okay?
Okay.
So wait one sec. I got to refresh because I already did mine. So... All right, hold on. Let's go back. I gotta get.
Were you taking a test while we were podcasting?
No, it takes. There's no test to it. You just click one box.
Oh, I thought there was a whole list.
No, remember what this is, Keith. This is a very scientific study. This is which Pixar movie are you based on your zodiac sign? So the only thing they need is your zodiac sign. So here we go, Keith. You ready?
I'm ready.
You're Leo. That means. You're Monsters, Inc.
You know what? I haven't seen Monsters, Inc., but probably if I did, that would be my Pixar movie.
Okay, are you ready for the big elaborate explanation for why you're Monsters, Inc.?
Lay it on me.
It says, and I quote, as a Leo, you're a generous and warm-hearted person.
Hey, can we stop right there? Would you agree with that?
No.
What?
I'm not. Let me read the rest, okay? Shut up. Here we go. I gotta go through the rest. All right. If you hypothetically found a little girl who had wandered into a dangerous place, you would probably go to any lengths to get her home. That's why you're Monsters, Inc.
It sounds good to me.
Do you feel like other people wouldn't do this? Like, other people would find a little girl and just, like, throw her to the street?
Most people, when they find a little girl, they probably wouldn't know what to do. They would just, they'd be very confused.
Oh, my God.
Why are you lost, little girl? And they wander away. I'm probably one of the very few people in the world who would know that it was my responsibility to help that little girl out.
Yeah, okay. So here's mine. Ready?
Yep.
So I'm a Gemini, so I got Toy Story 3.
That's supposed to be the best Toy Story. I don't know what you're complaining about.
So here we go. Geminis are adaptable, versatile, and clever, and our heroes had to use all of those traits to orchestrate their prison break in Toy Story 3. We're betting you would also be great at escaping the clutches of a desperate teddy bear. What is that? I mean, that is so fucking random. I can't even handle that. There's nothing about that that has anything to do with being born in June.
It makes me think about the power of astrology and how powerful that's been for so long. You know,
yeah.
Like the idea that people, there's this really human need to find order in the world. I suppose that's what makes our, as an animal, what makes us unique, you know, that we have this brain capable of reason. So we want to figure things out. And yet the downside of that is we look towards things that are not orderly, things that are chaotic or have no, say, real pattern, and we find a pattern. And astrology, I think, is a really good example of that. So the idea that you have this identity, which is completely make-believe, but it puts you in a category with other people who are also, like for me, a Leo, and you have these qualities assigned to you, and some of them you're going to agree with because they're quite general. And then you can look in the paper or consult an astrologist, I guess, and find this, prediction of the future, right? Like what's going to happen to you or lucky numbers, if it's a zodiac, that whatever the thing is. And that prediction and description, it's been around for centuries and centuries. People love it. People still love it, even though we know it's bogus. And probably some of these BuzzFeed lists and these little quizzes and tests probably sort of scratch the same itch that some of that old, silly astrology predictions did. You know, that's, I guess, it seems that way to me.
See, I think you give, I agree with you. I mean, I think it scratches the same itch. I think you give astrology way too much credit. I don't even think they have anything standardized in terms of what, like, a Gemini is.
Yeah.
Because I've read, like, 25 different definitions around it, what a Gemini is, and I don't think there's anything like, this is what a Gemini is. Or in the Chinese zodiac, this is what an ox is. Oxes only do this, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it seems like there's some overarching pattern to Leo. But you know what? Now that you say it, I don't know if I could even offer up what it is. It's usually something about being, like, humble and, like, big-hearted. But I don't know. And brave, which I'm probably not, but when I read that, I think, ah, ha, ha.
Yeah, exactly.
That's me, like, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, I don't know, I just get like, anyway, the other piece of it is I think oftentimes it really frustrates me when it's like socially irresponsible. Like, it'll be like 25 things that Bill Clinton has said, and like 13 of them aren't even things he's really said.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they put no fact-checking in. They clearly, like, did a Google search of, like, Bill Clinton quotes and then just started, like, throwing things down. Or, like, 23 times Oprah was controversial or something, and there's, like, not enough information that, like, even gives any context.
Is it that dangerous, though? Like, how many people do you think are really consulting that for news or for truth?
Oh, I think tons of people.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I think tons of people are doing that, like, all the time.
So, I mean, is this the downfall of Western civilization we're talking about here, these BuzzFeed lists, or is this an annoyance? Is this going away? What's your prediction for the future?
Well, here's what I think. I don't think it's a downfall of civilization, and I mean, people were uninformed long before BuzzFeed articles ever came along. But here's where I actually think that it has an impact on people's lives. Okay. So do you remember when, I think his name is Wyatt Cenac?
Yep.
He was like a Daily Show correspondent, right? And so a few weeks ago, Wyatt Cenac gave an interview with Marc Maron on the Marc Maron podcast. You remember this, Keith?
I do, yeah.
Okay. So essentially, Wyatt Cenac, he went around and he gave a very long, like 2-hour interview where he discussed essentially a really complex relationship with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. So when they were working together, he talked about how his dad had been, not Jon Stewart's dad, Wyatt's dad had been murdered when he was a kid, and how when he got into comedy, he was always looking kind of for a father figure, and Jon Stewart kind of became that father figure a little bit, but then Jon Stewart was like not meeting the expectations of what he kind of expected a father figure would be, and eventually that caused like tension between them, mm-hmm. and then he kind of talked to Jon about that, and then Jon didn't like respond well, because obviously like somebody being like, you should be my father figure without you knowing is kind of like an odd thing to bring up to somebody,
sure.
you know? And so then their like relationship got worse, and eventually he decided to quit The Daily Show because there was like too much tension about it, and they left, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he left the show. But what ended up happening was the results came out as like, oh, Jon Stewart is an asshole to Wyatt.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Yeah. It was a much more complex story, and the funny thing about it was Wyatt was like really upset about the stories too that were coming out.
Yeah, so it just took something that had subtlety, and it reduced it to something that was scandalous and simple.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, what's really unfortunate about that is it's like one of these things that's going to contribute to Jon Stewart having like this really negative reputation, especially at the end of his tenure as The Daily Show host.
Yeah.
You know, and it gives all his critics ammunition. And so that's what it means. To me, it's about more about social responsibility than it is about like anything sure, like, sure. Oh, people need to be informed by these lists or something. But it's when, what are the ramifications about people's choices when they are ill-informed about things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think for Stewart in particular, he has built up so much goodwill over the years that I don't see that as being a major issue. I think it's just kind of a blip on the radar that'll be kind of forgotten about. But the idea that something that requires nuance gets obliterated because the nuance doesn't fit into a BuzzFeed list or doesn't fit into a quick headline, doesn't fit into, you know, a 30-second or 3-second clip, is a real problem, because the world is full of subtlety and nuance, and to understand things properly requires attention to detail often. And I guess as long as the world gets more complicated, attention to detail becomes ever more important. And at the same time, our attention spans are at their extreme, and it seems like no one wants to dig in and really get to the meat of an issue or appreciate the nuance or the subtlety, maybe when it's needed most. So I guess the lesson to be learned from that is just an awareness that that's something that we do. Maybe that's something that can be taught as a kind of almost like a program in school, whether it's high school or college, just sort of how strategies for getting out of the weeds, or for appreciating that there's usually context behind the headlines.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I mean, and I really liked what you said about the whole thing with it's getting, like, the world is getting more complex, and we're trying more and more and more to, like, simplify things down, you know? Mm-hmm. And that I think is like spot on, like analysis, and like creates some serious, serious problems right there. So
there's a quote, and I heard Russell Brand give this quote, but it was someone, he was quoting someone else. So this is like a game of telephone. It's a couple generations removed, but it was something to the effect of tyranny is the removal of nuance. And I thought that was quite fascinating.
Yeah, that's awesome. Russell Brand said that?
Yeah, he was quoting someone else. But it reminds me of like George Orwell's Big Brother. You know, it's just these like loud bullhorn, simple sentences come from the powerful to the bottom. these black and white issues. Everything is black and white. Everything is loud. Everything is turned up to 11, and that is tyrannical, right? But freedom comes from subtlety, from nuance, from the complexity.
My God, that's awesome!
Isn't that a cool quote?
Yeah, I really like that. I really like that quote a lot. That's fucking really sweet. I really enjoy that.
Yeah, he's so, for such an really odd for such an oddball character whose brain is so like a cartoon or something. He is able to zero in on a lot of stuff that I think is really important. I noticed he ended he ended his trues.
Really? Yeah. How come?
I think it had just kind of run its it had run its course, and then he was also saying that it got to the point where it was interfering. Like he didn't feel like he was offering up anything new because the media cycle is so formulaic that he had begun to say the same things in response to the same kinds of news articles. So instead of like giving more content, he felt like he was just repeating himself. Like he had exhausted that as a method for critical reflection.
Wow.
Which I think is true, probably.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think, I mean, I agree with that too. Because I subscribed to his thing at first, and it just felt like, okay, like it was almost overload.
Yeah.
You know, it was like you're too many videos. Like I can't watch 10 videos a week, dude.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I felt the same way. So, I loved that at first, and then after a while, it was just too much of the same. So I'm kind of glad to see it come to an end. But he does now have this treasure trove of interesting segments that'll be online forever.
Right. No, yeah. That's
and I'm
true.
Interested now to see what he turns to, because I don't know if he'll try to get back into movies or if he'll pursue this sort of social activist role that he's carved out for himself in the UK.
Yeah. Probably a little bit of both, would be my guess. Yeah. So, Keith, I'm gonna hit you with some more BuzzFeed things really quick as we all right, ready for here's some more things that have popped up. Okay. So, here's one. After a guy lost his phone in the river, you'll never guess what pictures were posted on Facebook. So
what pictures?
No, I'm not going to tell you that. We're gonna work through this.
Okay.
All right, ready? 28 pictures that prove spacing is very, very important.
Spacing. I don't understand what that means.
Yeah, what it means is it's talking about spacing in your writing, and it's got an example that says the pen is broken, but it looks like it says the penis is broken.
All right, on to the next one.
All right. Do men think you're smart or pretty?
So this is aimed at women?
Yeah. So you'd click on this, and you'd have to figure out if, like, men, because I guess they polled all men in the entire world.
Yeah.
And like, everybody agreed, this is what makes you smart, and this is what makes you pretty. And this article is representative. All right. Here's another one. 26 underrated apps every 20-something should download right now.
26 sounds like an awful lot.
And why 26? Who knows? The thing is, again, is like it feels as if, like, you when you read it at first, you're like, oh man, like maybe one of these apps is going to be really useful. But the truth is, when you open them, you're going to have most of them already. And the ones you don't have, they're going to be useless. You know what I mean? Okay. Oh, how about this one? A dad had a priceless reaction to his son choosing an Ariel doll at the store.
Is it a video?
So essentially, like, you're never gonna believe what happens after this. Well, here's another one. There's now a Caitlyn Jenner Halloween
costume.
That's
in poor taste.
And again, like, it's kind of like, and it's got like a really masculine looking guy wearing Caitlyn Jenner's like outfit from Vanity Fair.
Yeah, that would be an odd if you had a whole family go out as like the Kardashians. Someone wore like the Kim Kardashian outfit, which I guess is not really much of an outfit. I'm thinking of that Paper magazine cover, just this bottle of champagne and a pasty. What did the whole family, the whole, you know, Kardashian family? That'd be a very wholesome costume, I think.
Yeah. How about this one? We know how much of a 90s kid you are. This one's not even a question. This one just says, we know how much of a 90s kid you actually are.
I may be. I'm from the 80s, but you know what? I grew up in the 90s. They're probably talking about me.
Oh, my God. Okay, how about this one? Guess how much this guy pays a month to essentially live in a Manhattan closet?
How much? Click on that one. I want to know. I got to know what that one is.
Fuck BuzzFeed. You have to not know, Keith. That's the thing. There's going to be nothing helpful on the other end of this click.
All right. Shall we sit in?
Clicked it for you. Here we go. Are you ready? Village Voice. Let me read it to you now. Village Voice recently got a tour of one of the most infamous tiny apartments in Manhattan. The tenant, Grayson Attenberg, a recent New York City transplant, care of Wisconsin, works at Lincoln Center Restaurant, and this is how he lives. And it's a very small apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all there is.
It doesn't give you a number?
It's 100 square feet.
It doesn't give you the price?
Oh, even better. It has you guess.
What are the options?
Okay, it's 850, 1,100, 1,850, 700, or 950, or my favorite, duh, he clearly pays for it with gourmet meals from his job.
I'm going for the max. I'm going all the way.
You were wrong. It's $1,100 he pays for this. That's about what I pay for my two-bedroom apartment here in Columbus, Ohio, that has a pool and a tennis court and a lot of other wonderful things that is way better than a one-bedroom or a 100-square-feet apartment. So.
And that guy's from Wisconsin.
He's from Wisconsin. He grew up milking cows.
All right. So do we have any conclusions on this? We've been droning on about BuzzFeed, but are we in protest? Is the Midwestern social scientist in protest against BuzzFeed?
Yeah, I am. I mean, it's not just BuzzFeed, though. It's any clickbait article because it's such a waste of your time. And you could be becoming an expert on something. You know, like, Keith, you love to do that.
Yeah.
Like, you learned the other day how to build, like, your own freaking water hydroelectricity plant.
Yeah.
Like, in your backyard. And, like, that was, like, what? A couple hours on the internet of watching people do it. And it's unbelievable. And instead, we waste our time on all these BuzzFeed articles.
That is a very good point. The downside is we have, because everything is clickbait, to be in protest against that is pretty much to become a hermit of a sort, to be in protest against CNN and MSNBC and Fox and most of the websites and BuzzFeed and such, and Twitter. I mean, it is a kind of clickbait nation, clickbait culture right now. It's tough to get outside of that. But you're absolutely right. When you have a lot of time on your hands and you start to dedicate those hours to one goal and the hours start to stack up, you can actually accomplish a lot of stuff. You can become a master at stuff. It's not that tough to be pretty competent at a lot of different things in life. But it does require consistency and discipline. And maybe that's kind of like the key to a lot of human potential, is not being a child where you're distracted every 20 minutes, but being an adult where you can maintain your concentration on one thing. Learn to speak French. Learn to play piano. Learn to build your own hydroelectric fan on a little creek like I was trying to do.
Yeah.
And I think those things are not only more rewarding. We're talking about pleasure before. That gives you like real pleasure. But it's not the kind of sugary pleasure that BuzzFeed gives you.
Right. I'm not even talking like becoming an expert piano player. That's like a thing that's like a really big goal. Here's what I'm talking, Keith. The girl at your school who could have been learning how to be a better GTA,
yep,
like a graduate teaching assistant, but instead she found out which Pixar character she was,
mm-hmm,
you know, on BuzzFeed. Like, she missed out on an opportunity to learn something about how to better treat her students because she was doing that. And that's what I think the problem is like we're missing all these, like, growth opportunities. And then we as a generation are also like the ones who are pissed off. Like, there's no jobs. Like, I'm so unemployed. Oh my God, I can't buy a house or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But we're the ones who are wasting our time all day, you know?
Yeah, if you spent those hours learning how to code or to do something more productive, maybe you'd be in a better situation.
Right. Man, it's almost like what cigarette smoking was back in the day. Like, you know, people would go outside to like smoke on a smoke break all the time, you know? Yeah. And that's like kind of what, instead of that now, we just like go on Reddit or we go on BuzzFeed or whatever, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a good analogy too. It's like something kind of pleasurable, but you also know it's killing you and you could be doing something more productive.
And not like wasting your time and money on it.
Yeah.
I guess people don't waste their money on BuzzFeed or anything like that, so.
No. Anyway. All right, we bringing this podcast to a conclusion now?
I think we are. You know, hit us up on Twitter. I know we have Kelsey read the thing at the end, but you know, Twitter's been hopping lately a little bit. Hit us up. Tweet me. Tweet.
Didn't we just condemn Twitter? I think I just condemned Twitter too.
No, not Twitter, man. BuzzFeed. I'm in
protest against our own tweets.
All right. Well, that's gonna make it difficult. We want to hear topics though from everybody. Tell us some topics you want to hear about, because we have a big list of topics and we can go on and on, but we'd rather customize them for people just like you.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, offer something up and we will use it. If it's a good idea, we won't hesitate. Our very next podcast may be that topic.
All righty then. All right, everybody. I am Dr. Kit Pietrantonio.
And this is Keith McIntosh, and I believe we will see you next week.
All right, goodbye.
Hey guys, if you enjoyed the show, check out Kip and Keith on Facebook at Midwestern Social Scientists. You can also tweet them at hashtag Midwestern Social Scientists. Or you can check out their Podomatic page, which is the first place the episodes get released. Don't miss out. Yeah, just check out their Facebook, okay? Thanks.